So I'd reiterate Fernando's appreciation for the stay here. It's been very fruitful. And speaking of six dimensions, we're going to switch to six dimensions. There's really no contact with what with the Brennonian discussion. So I'll give you a telegraphic description of various solutions in six dimensions that we've been looking at and why we're doing it. So here's roughly how I'd like to describe things to you. I'm going to give you a motivation for why you'd think about six-dimensional solutions of supergravities. I'll remind you what those supergravities are. I'll remind you of the first one that was done back in the 80s. There's a very simple solution to six-dimensional supergravity, one of the six-dimensional supergravities by Salam and Sezgin. Then I'll tell you about how you modify those things to put more general solutions, which are going to amount to having, there'll be solutions with singularities, which you could interpret as being the positions of various brains. And then you're going to see that that these systems are simple enough that there are general statements you can make. And in particular, it's recently been proven what the most general solution is subject to several symmetries, but where the symmetries that are assumed are not the flatness of space. And the statement of the theorem is that the general solution has four-dimensional flat space. So the question is going to arise, why are these things so flat? And that leads me to something I really would rather not talk about, but it's self-tuning. And that just when you thought it was safe to come out again, self-tuning is one of those topics where people's reaction is typically negative. And so Joe's was an example. When I told him about this 2 weeks ago, I told him about this, and he said point blank, well, so do you believe these things are going to self-tune? And it's kind of like being asked, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? There's no good answer, right? So you know, we're serious guys. We don't know if they self-tune or not. Probably they don't. But we want to know why they're not self-tuning. Well, you know, what's going on? Why are these things flat? And where's the tuning coming in? And that's the Where's Waldo finish line. Is that if you haven't had kids, you don't know this, but there's these books of Where's Waldo, where there's Waldos in there somewhere, you know, but it's hard to find them sometimes. And so the trick will be spot the fine-tuning. Weinberg's reaction was worse than Joe's. He said that self-tuning models to him are like perpetual motion to the patent office. He doesn't need to know why they're wrong. All right. So why would you look at these models? There's six-dimensional supergravity, and they're poor man's Calabi-Yau is one motivation. You see a lot of the rich enough that they have a lot of the physics in them that you have in 10 dimensions. You have Carl fermion supersymmetry, moduli stabilization through fluxes, anomaly cancellation in an interesting way. But they're simple enough that you can actually explicitly get your hands on the metric, and you can see as explicit functions what the fields are doing. And they're simple enough that they're now becoming, we're getting general theorems as to what the most general solutions are, subject to various symmetry assumptions. That's one motivation. Second motivation is there's a lot of discussion of the Randall-Sundrum model, and that's largely motivated by you've got brains to really ask how brains are, what the physics would be if we're trapped in a brain. You need to kind of know what the back reaction is. And in the Randall-Sundrum picture, you can do that because it's codimension one, and so that's the junction conditions are telling you how the back reaction works. Codimension two, you can do that too, because the back reaction of the metric to a point source in two dimensions is essentially a conical defect. And so you can analyze many of the issues that you would have had in five dimensions and six dimensions as well, and you can ask what's specific to five dimensions and what's more general. And it can all be done in a supersymmetric context. And it may be that we live in this kind of a world. Maybe in the string, it turns out that four dimensions are really small and six are bigger, and that might be the way it works. Okay. So these are the supergravities. And in the papers that we wrote, we actually dealt with both of them. But I'm not going to talk about one because it'd take too long. But they essentially differ. There's more than just these two, but these are the kind of representative ones. The Roman supergravity is non-chiral. They differ in their bosonic parts. They've got the dilaton, curvature, you know, three index form, Maxwell fields, and then they have a potential for this dilaton because they're gauge supergravities, and they essentially differ, these two, in the sign of that term, where the Romans one gives you the Andy Sitter kind of sign. And this G here is a gauge supergravity, so that you've gauged some spin one guy who's a partner of the graviton, and that's the coupling constant for that U1. It has a string pedigree. It comes from, people can get it from 10-dimensional supergravity. Salam Sezgin supergravity is chiral, so it's much more intricately constrained. It's anomalous in its original version, but you can make it anomaly-free using the Green-Schwarz mechanism by sticking in a lot of matter. It has the Sitter-like sign, and that makes it hard to get from string theories. And so there have been attempts to kind of get it from 10 dimensions, which I think it's fair to say are not completely successful in the sense that this one may be successful, but they get a supergravity which is different from both of these, but which agrees with the Salam-Sezgin bosonic part. So it has that potential in particular. And then there's more recently a truncation, which I think their statement is that they get this as a truncation of a 10-dimensional theory, but it's not clear exactly if that's a derivation from string theory, because what they get is actually the anomalous Salam-Sezgin thing rather than the anomaly-free extended theory. So I'm not sure exactly what the status is of that. All right, so now in the 80s, Salam and Sezgin took their theory and they said, well, you can do a kind of a Freund-Rubin ansatz, constant dilaton, maximally symmetric internal and four dimensions, and not necessarily flat, but so it could be any de Sitter or de Sitter. And they say, what's the solution? And what they found was a surprise. This thing they took to be, this corresponds to choosing a monopole on the two-sphere, on this maximally symmetric two-sphere. And they chose it to be n equals plus or minus 1. And they found that when you solve the equations, you didn't have to tune anything to get this thing to be flat. That was the surprise part. And the way that works is, if you look at the Einstein, the Maxwell, and the potential terms, then and you ask how do they depend on this modulus r, you can see that they go like, there's a 1 over r squared, 1 over r to the fourth, and follow the diltons, they group into a perfect square. And so what happens is that one combination of the radius and the dilaton is left free. One combination gets fixed, so that's like flux stabilization of that particular modulus. This is the T modulus in the string language. This would be the S modulus. And the minimum is at 0 because it's a perfect square. And that was kind of a miraculous thing at the time. And it was later understood because the, and this I think is going to be a false understanding, but the people stopped thinking about it, I think, because people also recognize that this choice of n equal, the one monopole number of 1 or minus 1 is the condition that you have one unbroken supersymmetry in four dimensions. And so then it kind of made people could believe that you could get a flat space. And in this particular thing, you can kind of see turns into a D term when you look at it in the effective four-dimensional theory. So there's kind of a Fayet-Laplace thing going on where there's an anomaly in the U1 and T is the multiplet that's helping to get that anomaly fixed, and that generates a Fayet-Laplace term, and that's kind of where that fixing comes from. Now, one of the new things is that Chris Pope, Gary Gibbons, and I don't know his first name, Gibbons, have proven that this is actually the most general non-singular, so the statement is, if you look for solutions where you do not assume maximal symmetry for the internal dimensions, but you do assume maximal symmetry, but you don't assume it to be flat in the four dimensions, and you assume that there's no singularities anywhere, then they prove that this is the only solution under those assumptions. And so flat space, six-dimensional space is included as being along this flat direction. This S modulus is free, and so there's a one-parameter family of solutions, and they're saying that's the only parameter. And so the supersymmetry of this thing could be helping here, but you're going to see that this kind of, if they have similar results for these more complicated solutions I'm going to describe, and the question is, and there it's also true that you're forced to have flat space, and so the question that we're heading for, and I'm not going to give you the answer to really, because I don't know, is why these things are always flat.
Well, you're assuming this maximal symmetry, right? If you're sharing it in the vacuum energy, it would depend on, let's say, some scalar field, and then the scalar field would depend on time and so on.
Yeah?
And then you would not have something maximally symmetric.
Right. Why not? In four dimensions, I could. I could have the Sitter space, or I could have any
because system. The scalar field would grow, because the vacuum energy you're sharing depends on the scalar field, and then the scalar field would start changing. And so.
You're saying if I started here and I moved it somehow, I wouldn't be able to get enough energy at all at once to get to something maximal.
Just take string theory and add a tree level cosmological constant. The solution
okay.
is linear dilaton. Like,
okay.
The dilaton breaks the maximal symmetry.
Okay.
So he's just saying you get a linear dilaton-like solution with S.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, this solution only fixes a combination of R and phi, and not.
I think this statement would be a surprise for Clapeyres, for instance. This would be saying you couldn't get any de Sitter space, which you do get, right? So. There are solutions in 10 dimensions where you can get any de Sitter space.
Well, I think if you start, let's say, with VR gravity, you probably can't get a Sitter anti de Sitter. You can only get flat. Probably.
Yeah, but this isn't good. Yeah.
Well, but it might be VR gravity in disguise, because it could be that the gauge fields that are appearing here are some internal directions of some Calabria. There's an example that I'm more familiar with. It's not this, I think, eight-dimensional Salam-Sezgin supergravity. There's
okay.
another one, which is somehow the near horizon of the six frames. And so in M theory, they are pure geometry, and they have similar properties. There is similar properties.
Okay, I'd like to talk to you about that for then, because I don't understand it yet, but then it's,
But let's see, I think it is correct to say that only one scalar space gets fixed, not both, right?
Right, one combination gets fixed, right.
Right, so the once you generate the vacuum energy, the R combination can start growing.
Well, for instance, the surprise to me would have been, supposing I didn't take monopole number one, I took monopole number two. You could ask, what's the solution in that case? And I've broken supersymmetry. Why should I expect the answer to be flat? And it still is flat. And you have no choice of getting a solution where it's the sitter space or it's energy sitter space. And in that case, what happens is that the solution is warped and there's a singularity somewhere. But you have no option where you can make this thing be the sitter space or energy sitter space, no matter what you tune. Anyway, I'd like to talk to you about that afterwards, because it's... If you have an answer, that's what I want to know. All right, so now what about the brain solutions? The simplest things to do, I shouldn't put this on the top because there's people in the room that are being referred to. So Sean and others looked at these things in a non-supersymmetric context. The simplest way to get a...
We should not call it a football.
I know, there's a cultural thing. I called it a football until my collaborators in Europe said that there's a cultural ambiguity in the shape of a football.
We call it an American football.
Well, that's too many words.
You got the Euro on the way on
this. Yeah. So the upshot is that if you wanted to kind of stick brains into that solution I told you about just now, one thing you could do is just you still get a solution if you stick a brain in have a conical singularity at the top north and south pole and you just remove a wedge, and the gravitational field of an energy source is a conical singularity, so you're kind of arranging for one to be here and here, and later on you can interpret those as being the positions of two, three brains. Well, you can't embed these things in. this is a European football. here's a solution. And since we're going to be asking why they flat, you're going to want to know, you know, the things you should have in your mind are, where did he fine tune? And so one of the things you're going to watch for is are tunings getting made anywhere? And there is a tuning that has to happen here, which I'm going to talk more about in a second, but it's essentially, there's two tunings I'm going to talk about. One of them is that the defect angle here and here is the same. That's kind of obvious from the picture. It won't be true in the other things I'm going to show you. Another one is that there's a magnetic flux quantization condition, which if you chase it through, says that there's an integer, which you can kind of think, if you're integrating f over the space here, you've removed some volume, so it looks like you wanted to change the quantization condition, and that's not quite what happens. But you end up getting a condition which expresses that there's two coupling constants, which I'll describe in a second, whose relationship has to be related to this defect angle and an integer. These couplings are this g hat is the one that was in the scalar potential, so it's a specific u1 in the model that was gauged that gave you the dilaton potential. This g is the g which is the coupling for whatever the Maxwell field was that you turned on, that was the monopole. And so if it had been in that U1 that was in this one, then this would be the same G. And this says you can't do that if you have a defect angle here. Whereas you could do that in the Salam-Sezgin case where the defect angle was zero. So there's a constraint there, which is essentially, bottom line is you're relating two different coupling constants in your theory to each other to have the solution exist. So one of the motivations for asking for more general solutions is, to what extent was that generic? I mean, is it something which is a special feature of choosing this particularly simple solution, or what? And the answer is easy to state. It's here's some warp solutions. And the most general solutions now by the same people, which have under the assumptions that the four dimensions are maximally symmetric, the internal dimensions are axially symmetric, so there's just the rotations in one direction around the sphere. And the dilaton and the warp factor are non-singular, even where these conical defects are. Under those assumptions, the most general solution is known. And it's a little bit more general than this one, I think. But it's, you know, they have the same features, that they have one or two singularities. And if you ask, there's kind of a non-trivial warping going on. The other thing you should know is everything else is essentially the same. The dilatons, none of them are supersymmetric because the dilaton is varying, is the other thing. The analog of this condition that you can't see anymore is still there because it's a topological constraint. It just essentially says that the Chern class is fixed. And there's another constraint, which is the analog of saying that the two defect angles at either end of the wedge had to be equal. Now they're not equal, but they're still related to each other. If you know what one is, you know what the other one is. That's the Euler number constraint. And those are so you get two topological constraints always, essentially, is what's happening, the bottom line there. One thing I forgot to say as I went by it was, it's still here. There's going to be some numerology I'm going to tell you about in a second. And one thing, one picture you could, if you wanted a set of scales to think about in terms of this model here, where it's not warped, would be, this would be a supersymmetric large extra dimension scenario. And the numerology I'm going to tell you about in a second will be based on, in that scenario, you would have had the tensions here and the gravity scale being the weak scale. And then you would have chosen the radius here to be something like, you know, 1/10 of a millimeter to get the Planck mass right. And in that picture, in the supersymmetric version of that picture, supersymmetry is broken on these brains because that's the weak scale. So there's no approximation within which the brains look supersymmetric. But the bulk is supersymmetric, and the supersymmetry breaking scale in the bulk is the Kluze-Klein mass. And that is essentially 1 over r, and that's 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, which is the cosmological constant scale. And so what's tantalizing there is that there's, you know, most of this theory is supersymmetric, and the supersymmetry breaking scale is the scale that you would want to account for the cosmological constant. So just keep that thought in your head. So the moral of that story is that if you were ever to find a self-tuning model that worked, that's where you'd want to find it, because the scales work.
But sorry, there's a thing there about flat space being
right.
That certainly is not true. And if you just, I mean, that's true in the super graph.
If you did what you did.
Yeah. Just put E and M in 6 dimensions, then that's not true.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah, because so what Sean is saying is that if you took Maxwell theory, or you just took a cosmological constant and dialed it to make the, you can dial it to make the 4 dimensions flat or anti-sitter space or de-sitter space or whatever you want, but you don't have that dial here. You can relate the properties of the things that were related by topology. You can relate them to the properties that the brains would have had if they were the sources of the metric you're looking at, let's say. So if you took the things living at those two defects to have that action, then the fact that the dilaton is non-singular means that you can't really be coupling to the dilaton, because the consistency of the delta function you're getting in the dilaton equation with the bulk part would have said that the derivatives as you come into the singular into the north pole, for instance, would all be different in different directions, and so you couldn't be going to a non-singular place. So you can learn you can translate the statements about the properties of the solution into properties of the sources. And the defect angles get related to the tensions of the brains through the standard relationship. And there's a term in the action that you could have written down, which I didn't talk about, but you know, this 2-form in 6 dimensions gets dualized to a 4-form, which you could have integrated over the position of the 3-brain. That whole vibrating effect is pretty cool. All right. And this would correspond, I think, to the question mark here is that this part I'm telling you now is not thought through right to the end, but I think it corresponds to putting a delta function flux in the magnetic field at the position of these 3-brains. And the reason I tell you that is that the constraints that I had before, the one that looked the nastiest was that the two coupling constants were being related to each other. And I want to argue that those constraints, those topological constraints, are really constraints on that relate the charges at one end in the North Pole, say, to the other end in the South Pole. And that's obvious in the case of the tensions, because in one case, it was the two defect angles are the same, which said that the tensions had to be the same. But in this topological case for the magnetic field, if I had had this source, delta function sources for the magnetic field, then what I wrote before, which was this, would have had a new term, which was the difference between these charges at the 2 brains. And so this, in that case, has got an interpretation which is more similar to asking for the tensions to be equal. It's constraining, it's not constraining the charges. It's saying, given couplings in the bulk, there's a relationship that's being forced between the two magnetic fluxes on the 2 brains. OK, so 2 more slides. So why is this being flat? So in detail, you can kind of see why it's flat. And it's being flat. It's flat for a reason which is people have remarked on in the past. These people have remarked on in the past. If you kind of ask, if I just explicitly sit down, take that solution, take all the Kluze-Klein modes and integrate them out classically and ask, what's the effective 4-dimensional cosmological constant I would see? And why is it 0? Because it has to be 0 given the solution was flat. What you get is that there's a contribution which is coming directly from the tensions of the brains, which is the one you expect. Then there's something coming from the integral over the action of the bulk over the 2 dimensions. And what's happening is that the curvature in the bulk has a singular part, which is the delta functions that are responding to the stress energy of the brain. Then there's a smooth part, which is the sphere. And the singular part, the Einstein equation, relates to the tensions with some number there, which I didn't write down, but it's known. And the point is that when I plug that singular part into here, it is exactly canceling the tension. And that's why the tensions are going away. And it's flat regardless of what the tensions were.
I'm sorry. I thought the first example of this didn't have any brains. You just put a monopole on the 2-sphere.
Yeah, that had no brains at all, right?
There was no brains.
And that was also supersymmetric, right?
Okay. But there's still a question there, right?
Yes.
Why the minimum is at zero?
And that would be the t equals zero example of what I'm doing here, because what happens besides this cancellation is that all the rest cancels too.
Yeah.
And that's happening in that particular case. But for a supersymmetric solution, so for the supersymmetric case, you expected that to happen anyway, because you knew that there were going to be no corrections to the, if you start at zero, you stay at zero. But when I say it was a supersymmetric solution, that's actually only true if I choose the background magnetic field to be in the direction of that U1 whose coupling is appearing in the potential. And a different direction would have broken supersymmetry. And so, but it's still true that it's flat. So this is actually very similar to what happened in five dimensions. And it's also, it turns out that what happened in five dimensions is a special case of what Weinberg discussed in the late 80s about self-tuning. So self-tuning in this sense is kind of has a pedigree. Weinberg essentially described and criticized models for which you essentially arrange for the trace of the stress tensor to be proportional to somebody's field equation, which then when you satisfy the field equation gives you zero all the time. Running it that way, you can kind of see if I put minus equals zero, that's essentially saying there's a scale invariance in the problem. And in this case, there's a scale invariance. But you know that supergravity has this classical scale invariance. And as long as the couplings of the brains don't ruin that, it should be true that this kind of a mechanism is working. And that's why you're going to get zero when you look at this, do a calculation like I did up there. And you can do what I did up here under the assumption that I had not chosen the dilaton couplings, for instance, to be zero. It turns out that for three brains, the condition that the scale invariance of the bulk be preserved by the brains is the condition that the dilaton coupling is zero. But if I'd chosen it to be something else from zero, I can still make this argument and ask how it would have gone. And what happens is it doesn't cancel. And so you can really trace the vanishing, the flatness of this of the four dimensions to this classical scale invariance. And so that suggests that it's not specific to six dimensions or five dimensions. But it also suggests that it's a classical phenomenon. It's not something you expect quantum mechanics to preserve.
So in this model, it's a massless
field? Yeah, it has a flat direction, so it's got a massless modulus along there. And but if I had put in, yeah, no, that's.
In the six-dimensional example with flux, if the flux is in the wrong direction, you said you still get zero energy?
Yes.
Do you understand that as a four-dimensional n equals one theory with a non-zero superpotential, or what? How do you understand that in four-dimensional language? I'm kind of asking, is this the same as no-scale supergravity?
Yeah.
Is this, and then the first loop correction ruins the no-scale structure, and you get
a... Yeah, I think it is. I don't know for sure, but I think it is. There's no reason why you'd expect it to go to survive loops. That's true. What happens in five dimensions, you remember, is that if you had something here, you get some sort of a junction condition, and then there's typically a singularity over here somewhere. And if you interpreted that as being the position of another brain, then the tension that you would read off from the singularity would be the thing that you would have adjusted to make the cosmologic constant vanish. And so if you ask, does that kind of thing go through here, the analog of that other brain is these constraints, these topological constraints I gave you were the analogs of those things that related tensions on the circle. And so, if you ask the question, is what's happening in six dimensions the same as what's happening in five dimensions? At one level, it's yes, in the sense that there are these two topological constraints which are relating the properties of the brains at two sides in such a way that you need that to get the solution at all, and then the solution is also flat when you get it. Now, that's good. So we understand something. But the question really is, for the cosmologic constant, is are those conditions stable against renormalization through scales that are very short? And since they're topological, you would have thought that they should be stable under very short. If I told you that I can only have if magnetic flux is quantized, or I said that the total charge of a bunch of charges in a compact dimension is zero, you wouldn't have expected those things to change as I renormalize things. And so, because topology is typically about long wavelength things, and if I integrate things that are short compared to the size of the extra dimensions, it's hard to see how topology could care. And so, I don't know that it doesn't care. I don't know that it does care. But there's an issue there that I'd like to understand. But I can't tell you the answer yet. I don't know what the answer is. So there's three issues here that I think are the ones that need to be understood. One of them is that. Why are these topological conditions? You know, in the case of the five dimensions, you explicitly had a negative tension against the positive tension, so that looked like you tuned something and said, oh, of course, that's what's going on. Here you've got only positive tensions. And the negative thing is the curvature, which is canceling it, the singular part of the curvature. And so there's a... It may be the same physics, but you want to ask if it's stable under normalization. Second thing is, it's a funny thing to have these tensions be equal to each other or related to each other, because what happens if I'm living on that brain and there's a phase transition and the tension changes all of a sudden? What's it going to do? And I think probably what you said is right, that you're going to leave the assumptions of the solutions and that you're going to have time-dependent solution or you're going to have something inhomogeneous or something, but you want to understand how that works. So how do perturbations, which change those tension conditions, how does the system react to that? And the third thing is quantum corrections. How big would you expect them to be? The tantalizing thing is that Klutze-Klein mass of the fourth could be the right answer. But you know that scale invariance, so it's actually good that scale invariance here is only classical. If it were true that this was the answer you got from the quantum corrections, you'd be happy. So if you had to estimate how big would the corrections be, the one thing to keep in mind is that the effect, the one thing that's different about this picture compared to the normal picture is that at the scale of the cosmologic constant, if you're doing a large extra dimension scenario, the theory really is six dimensional. So you should classify your ultraviolet effects in six dimensions where you're constrained by six dimensional general covariance. So you get things like curvature terms, curvature squared terms, and so on. And these would be the cutoff scale up, like the string scale or the weak scale in that case. And so if you then asked how big are these things in the vacuum energy, each of these curvatures is like 1 over r squared, and there's overall volume, which is like r squared. And so this would be an m to the fourth, this would be an m squared, m Klutze-Klein squared, and this would be something which is small enough to be agreeing with the size you want. These things are probably not dangerous, because those are like renormalizations of the supergravity Lagrangian. And so the analysis could have been done after I renormalized. But these are the ones that I don't understand why they should not be there. And so they may or may not be there. If this is how big the answer is, it's already an improvement, right? If this is the weak scale squared and this is the 10 to minus 3 electron volt squared, that's a lot smaller than you thought it was going to be. But I don't know the statement as to whether or not this is the size. Tantalizingly enough, there's a calculation by Benacli and Antoniadis and somebody with a torus-like version of this. It's string theory in one loop, and they claim that the answer is the Klutze-Klein mass to the fourth. But I don't know, even if they're right, I don't understand why, you know, to what extent something was chosen or how that plays out. But so I think these are the three remaining issues. And I hope I persuaded you that they're really worth pursuing. So thank you. It's not known how to derive from string theory, yeah.
And yet people are putting brains in it.
Not D brains. Not, these are not honest to God brains in the way that this room would think were brains, because there's no Ramon field coupled to them. It's really what's being done is that there's it's just you've got a solution and you're asking what kind of a singularity, what the properties have to be of the singularity to describe, to give rise to that solution. That's, that would be, yeah, it's a function of the radius and the dilaton. And
so really, it's a runaway.
It's always going to give you a runaway, right. So the thing is that what I know you can do is that if it was mkk to the fourth, you could still be happy, because you can make a model. If your potential is something like 1 over r to the fourth times, you know, the series in 1 over r to the fourth, but if you really knew that it was 1 over r was the scale that was important, you can make a quintessence model of that. So you can make cosmology work, because the energy scales involved are the right scales. It wouldn't be a constant, that's all. You'd have to, you know, it's not sure that the generic thing works, but you can make one if you work at it. And I just know that because I've done it, so.
So, at the risk of getting into discussion about self-tuning, I just wanted to mention that it is one of those rare ideas from string theory that it's probably actually ruled out experimentally.
In what sense?
In that it secretly is the reason it works is to change the treatment.
Because of the existence of a dilaton, you mean, or?
It changes the right-hand side, so it's not just rho, but rho plus p. So as long as p minus rho, it doesn't show up, it doesn't push around the bubble. But it's hard to fit in the synthesis or something.
Yeah, but how do you know that so generally? Because I think I should be able to take that theory and put it into a limit where I could get four-dimensional cosmology to look right if I made the extra dimension small, for instance. How do you, that must be a, it's a very general statement.
The nice thing about self-tuning is that if you change the vacuum energy, the four-dimensional geometry stays flat.
But when you say self-tuning, what do you mean by self-tuning?
I think that's what I mean.
Well, this may not be the same self-tuning, I don't know, but I'd like to actually hear more about it, because it may be the same, I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that the whole point of self-tuning was it didn't matter what the tension was. we always get a flat.
Yes.
So that has, I think that's supposed to be true even if the tension changes as a function of time.
That's what I'd like to be true. I don't know if that's true here. That's one of the points. But if it, so if it was true, you're saying you could rule it out. Okay, I'd like to hear that. That's,
you're saying it changes cosmology, not just cosmological energy conflicts, but also matter relations.
That's right, because when you change something, how does it know to change the cosmological constant? And the answer is it changes the right hand side of the field.
You know, it's always rho plus p in the field.
Well, that's what changes.
So, I mean, that is what it should be, and we did some models, and that's what it is. I can't prove to you that is what it was always. In fact, sorry, if I try to become the model, there is rho plus 2p or something like that. But in the models that you actually want to get rid of the cosmological constant, it's going to be rho plus 2.
But it sounds like there must be, to get, because there's the scales involved are the cosmological constant of 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, and then cosmology now is like 10 to the minus 30 electron volts or something like that. So it sounds like there must be some light degree of freedom running around, which is changing things now to have an effect. So what would that be?
Well, there is a massless.
There is. It's like a quintessence, something rolling, which is doing the job, right?
It's just massless in the straightforward and simplest model. But
I can believe that you'd be in trouble phenomenologically for that. But I think that's actually, it's going to be unlikely. It's hard to get masses to stay that light under radiative correction. So I bet that if I get radiative corrections, which are 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, that's going to lift everybody to that scale. And then that'll be cosmologically inactive at late times in the universe. But without knowing what your real model is.
As long as the energy density is higher than 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, we have the same problem, and nucleosynthesis is certainly
wrong. Oh, yeah, nucleosynthesis, you might have to worry about it, right? Right. Yeah.